6 and 7, and as of right now, I don't have anything else to offer on that, so I'm going to add it off to you.
Thank you.
Because I've stolen this stuff. In back, Chris.
You guys talk about the ideal at the end of the inventory, how you kind of arrive at that, how you do it.
The sex inventory?
End of the inventory, yeah. The end of the sex inventory.
All right. The book talks about establishing an ideal in your sex conduct. And, you know, the first time I saw somebody trying to write an ideal was this guy that I said, "So what does your ideal look like?" And he said, "Oh, about 5'2" and blonde." And I said, "I think you missed the point." At least for us, the sexual ideal has to do with what we're bringing to the party. And that means, what am I willing to do in a relationship to make it work? And so my ideal has to do with putting someone else's welfare above my own. It has to be to do with being open and communicating and kind and trying to really do something to add something positive to the other person's life on a regular basis. I suppose it's a lot like that little short prayer in the book which says, "How can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done." Not always. My ideal really has to do with how am I going to act and what am I bringing to a relationship? And in trying to define that is a good exercise, because you have to go back and look at it periodically and to see if you're doing what you said you were going to do. My ideal doesn't change much, or hasn't for probably the last 10 years. The last relationship I was in, I was trying to practice, which is a couple of years ago, I was trying to practice the principles that I had chosen. And I think it was the neatest relationship I've ever been in my life. And the only reason why it stopped was because there was a compelling reason in the middle of it where she needed to do some other things, and one of which was to have children. And I'm too old. I don't want to have children at this age. I think it's unfair. And I had to tell a lady that I was just wildly in love with, that the best thing for her was to go find someone who was willing to have children with her and then go on about her life. And it absolutely killed me. But it was the best thing for her. So, you know, you're going to establish some principles, some rules for the road in your life. And then the next question is, do you have the courage to live that way? Are you willing to make decisions which may not be in your own best self-interest, but that may be in their interest? And are you willing to live like that and then not sit around and bitch about it for the rest of your life? So, you know what? I spent a lot of time thanking God that that woman was in my life for as long as she was. And I'm not angry because she's not in my life any longer. I'm grateful that I had the time to spend with her, that I did. So part of that, coming to that kind of understanding, was writing out a sexual ideal. The book makes an interesting statement about our sexual conduct, and that is, if it continues to help other or to harm others, we're sure to drink. Listen to that. That's not a lie. If your sexual conduct is harming someone, and you decide to ignore it and continue that kind of behavior, don't be surprised if you got a bottle in your hand one of these days. And I've seen that happen over and over again. And you know, some people go, well, hell, I can get away with it. Well, that's just like getting away with it with alcohol. There's no such thing. At some point, all that stuff comes home to roost. And so you may want to consider that. Now, so we're going to talk about 6 and 7?
Just a minute. I came about that from the other end, if you will. I had come to see how much harm I had caused with my infidelity and chasing after my feelings and that sort of thing. And when I finished the fifth step with those guys up in Chicago, and I'd done those things, and that I had to do something about my sexual ideal and that sort of thing, I looked at the book and looked at that, and all I could really see was the harm I was causing until I began to try to write down the ideal. But the lie in there was that I wasn't like the rest of those other alcoholics, and I could get away with that and not drink. And probably not a week going by from what I see an alcoholic man go out and fall in heat with some gal and watch the process. They move out of the safe place they're living, and then they decide to move in with her. What was that line I heard the other day? What do two alcoholics do on their second date? Rent a U-Haul. Yeah, that's a... And so the discarding of that lie was one thing, but establishing the ideal was really something else, and that I had to come down to that. And so much of my amends to my wife were wrapped around that ideal, and they really were. So I don't do anything with another woman that I wouldn't do right in front of her. We had a wonderful woman in Indianapolis named Melinda, and some of you knew her, and she carried the messages better than anybody I've ever seen at times, I think. In fact, we would go through co-ed workshops together, and she would embarrass me because she would catch me with my fears, and so she'd rub them in, make them real apparent to me. She only did it once per fear, but it was a great help to me with that. But one time we ran into each other at a restaurant, and without thinking or anything else, we gave each other a full kiss on the lips. I mean, it was just impulsive. It was just right now, and it seemed like to both of us to be the thing to do. And I didn't think anything about it, of course, you know, other than that, damn, that was nice. Linda called later that afternoon and said the same thing to me. And so I told her, I said, well, I think we're all right, Linda, as long as we don't do anything we wouldn't do right in front of Julie. And she said, we better not do that again. And we didn't. But and it wasn't, I mean, that's just what it was. But with that, so much of my ideal had to do with me being what I signed up to be 50 years ago when we got married. And I literally hadn't done it in my marriage, Charlie, at all up until 20-some years ago now, 24 again. Not that that's a big deal, but it changed my life, and it changed it dramatically. That doesn't mean we still don't have discussions around that and how I can be forgetful and how I can be crude and and all of that, but that's part of me staying within the ideal. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. Mine came as a result of becoming aware of all the harm, all the pain I'd caused, not just to her, but to other families and everybody else.
Let me say something quickly about shooting baby ducks. Do you know what that is?
I dare you to say it.
It's screwing a newcomer. So there's a misconception there. We had a lady that joined our home group that was a former runner-up for Miss whatever, some state. And she was a very, very attractive woman. And when she came walking in the door newly sober, and there was a guy in our group with about 15 years of sobriety that immediately thought that was easy pickings and that he was going to go give her a ride on his motorcycle. And she went along with it, and not too many days later they were off together. And I went to this guy in my home group and I said, "You see what's going on there?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Now, what do you think's going to happen?" And he said, "He's taken advantage of her, and that she's gonna suffer from the consequences of that." And I said, "You got it backwards. That guy is going to go out, and she is about three grades above anything he's ever had in his whole life. And one of these days, she's going to turn around, look at him, and say, well, that was fun. And good luck." And see, people who just come through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous aren't looking for a relationship. They may be in lust, but they're not in love. And about 3 months later, she turned around one day and said, "That was a lot of fun. So, let's be friends and I'll see you." And it about killed him. And so, this is not the right thing to say at an AA group. You know that looking for a partner in Alcoholics Anonymous is like shopping in the dented can aisle?
That's right. That's right.
What the hell would ever possess you to go looking for someone who obviously has some level of insanity? That doesn't mean you aren't, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't. It just means that the odds aren't that much in your favor. And if you go to someone that's new in Alcoholics Anonymous and think you're going to be in a relationship, you're not. You're going to be in a hostage situation. So, you know, there are some people who get together in Alcoholics Anonymous and it'll last forever and they really love each other. And there are legions of examples of that around. But the real truth is, if you're looking for a partner, come on. Why are you doing it here? The answer to that, by the way, is this is where we spend most of our time. So,
I'll just put another twist on that. You got two totally self-centered people thinking the other one's going to fix them. It's crazy. Is that what you wanted, Chris?
I have another question, kind of, since we were bringing up the self-esteem issues, not worthiness, whatever you talk about. Do you have any experience with outside help, like therapies, that work with molding a healthier relationship? guys have any experience with that as far as integrating with the work you're doing?
I'm in that business. You should never ask me about therapy because I... Do you know, I used to train parole officers in the state about how to communicate. And so I trained all these parole officers, and the woman who runs the parole division in Colorado came up to me and she said, "What do you think about getting involved with therapy? Because we need a good provider and we really like doing business with it." And I said, "Well, I don't believe in it for myself." They used to send me to psychiatrists when I was a kid, and I showed up at my psychiatrist's office one day, and I said, "Oh, I have an appointment with Dr. So-and-so," and the nurse looked at me, and she said, "Oh, didn't you hear?" And I said, "No," and she said, "He committed suicide this week." And I went, "All right, something's wrong here. You know, if my psychiatrist is committing suicide, I wonder what the hell is going on." I think that there are people who truly benefit from therapy. And I'm one of the largest providers of therapy, my company is, in psychiatric care in Colorado for the Department of Corrections. And I think a lot of that, at least from personal observation, because I'm no therapist, is the intent of the therapist. And if they have a good heart, I think it has a tendency to heal people who are looking for a solution. And some of them are well versed in whatever kinds of therapy they're supposed to be doing, but. You know, if you have a real mental illness, and I deal with people like that every day, the people who are bipolar or schizophrenic or someone with a real mental illness, that there are real things to do about that, which brings up the idea of medication. So as long as we're talking about everything else, fucking right. There are people with real problems that need real medications, and if you're going to stand there and tell them not to take medications, you got your head up your ass. You know, unless you're an MD, leave your opinion out of the goddamn meeting, okay? And so, There are also millions of people in this country who don't like to feel bad, not even occasionally. You know, people go, "Well, I'm depressed." Really? How long? And you know, if you're always depressed, you ought to go see a doctor about it. If you got depressed this week because your job didn't go right, live with it. All right? I am, even in the business, even being this sober this long, am occasionally depressed, seriously depressed. Do I go get medication for it? No. What did people do 50 years ago?
Nothing.
They had nothing to do, so they just felt depressed. You know, I have psychiatrists that are working for me and they go, "Well, you seem depressed." And I go, "I am. That's very observant of you." And they say, "Well, I can give you something for that." And I go, "No, you can't." You know what? It's part of life. So you do what you want to do. But I want to see life as it is. And I want to get as close to reality as I can get. And I want to get as close to the truth as I can get. And so I don't engage in it. You have a right to do anything you want to do. But don't take yourself out of reality just because you don't like it. So what's the truth? The truth is some people ought to be medicated. Some people shouldn't. And there are both kinds of people that we're going to run across in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you see someone who is continually profoundly depressed, it's not the worst thing in the world for them to hear from you that they ought to seek medical help. I've told people that I sponsor to go find medical help. And are there other people who are just such profound weenies that they can't stand a little pain? Yeah.
There you go, pussy footing around again.
Yeah. Just be a little judicious how you use medication. I watch people who are on medication all the time. Some of them work and some of them don't. And some of them do just exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to do. And people like us have had serious suicide rates on things like Prozac and Wellbutrin and Zoloft and some of those things that doctors who work for me regularly prescribe, but they just understand that feeling bad or feeling depressed is part of life. And just statistically, at any given moment, one-third of the industrialized world is clinically depressed. So, you know, it's not something that just came out of the blue and you're the only one it had ever happened to. So please understand that some things are part of life and that we don't have to get stupid through too much medication to survive it. Sometimes it's just get through it. That's an opinion, which means you can throw it right out the window. Should have never got off of that.
Step six.
Wait a minute, one more. I don't know the answer to that. I think he was asking if there any distinction between the terms egocentric that Bill uses in the big book and self-esteem. That's primarily the ones you mentioned, didn't it? Those are the two terms you mentioned. A number of years ago, I was taking a young man through the book, and he was reading. And the line that reads in that, where Bill says, egocentric, as they like to call it nowadays, this kid's reading along and he bops right to it and he says, codependent, as they like to call it nowadays. And hell, he'd gotten two more sentences past it before I heard what I said. I said, just a minute. The hell do you say? He said, he grinned. He said, I said, codependent. And I looked at that and he says, doesn't that mean the same thing? Apparently it's pretty close. And I don't see that at all as part of self-esteem. Egocentric, I think, could be self-seeking. We're being led around just to feed our ego. But don't get too caught up in a single term in the book. It's really not worth it. Most of us have now have found out that if we're talking about something that's selfish, we're talking about something that's mine and you can't have it. And if I'm talking about self-seeking, it means it's something that's yours and I want it. I'm fixing to get it. With that, but don't spend too much time on that because we got enough head games without doing that. Step six. Go ahead.
You got a better story.
Okay. That so we come out of the inventory, we come out of the fifth step, and then...
Wow.
Then we're directed to go home and take the book down from the shelf and review the first five proposals. See if we've made mortar without sand. And then in the sixth step, we're asked to become willing to be rid of all of those things which kept us from the sunlight of the Spirit. And are we willing? I had mentioned to you before that there are two places in the big book where I throw myself at God's feet without reservation. And here's the other one. The other one's a seventh step, but I have to find the willingness in the sixth step to throw myself at God's feet again and without reservation. And that means that I'm willing to accept anything that God has in mind. And so when it describes the seventh step, it talks about, I'm now willing that you have all of me, good and bad, but my problem is that I don't know which is good and which is bad. And it says in that prayer, and I don't want to get that far ahead of myself, but it says that I now ask God to remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. You might have noticed at some point during this thing that I'm very opinionated. I'm also very candid, and that means that I'm going to tell you the truth if I think you ought to hear it. I always thought being that aggressive was a character defect. I mentioned last night at that meeting that I was working with inmates and that my ex-wife said I'd finally found a job that suited my personality. And I always thought, see, I was a bill collector in Chicago. I used to kick in people's doors and put them up against the wall and scare the bejunior out of it. And just be almost sociopathic, in fact, probably sociopathic in the way I went about it, which was why I was so good at what I did. And I always thought being that almost that angry and aggressive was a terrible part of my personality. And I have been asking God for more than 36 years that I am now ready that He takes all me good and bad and remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to Him and my fellows. And I have said that with real willingness to be rid of anything that He would take away. He's never done that. And some people will say it's because you don't want to get rid of it. Okay, I want to get rid of it if God wants to take it. But I have to be willing to lose any part of my personality. Any part. And one of the biggest challenges in being willing to get rid of those things is that's the way we defend ourselves. The reason why I am so direct is because I've always defended myself that way. Then people will be afraid of me and they won't challenge me and all the rest of that. See? So those things, that, and a lot of things that I am today, are things that I have defended myself with for years. And am I willing to drop the defense? One of the first things I said to you was, stop defending yourself. If you're living a spiritual life, What the hell are you defending? I don't have to defend myself. If you don't like me, you write inventory about it. I'm going to go to bed tonight and sleep like a baby. So finding the willingness to lower my defenses, to stop defending myself, is a pretty scary proposition. And all of those things that I've developed for all of those years to protect myself from you, am I willing to drop the whole deal and to be vulnerable? Are you? Are you willing to drop your defenses? That's what the sixth step is about. Am I willing to be anything that God chooses? Again, just like the third step. So I have asked God for years, for as long as I've been doing it, to take away what he doesn't think works, and I'm still direct, and I'm still aggressive, and I suppose one of the big reasons is because of the population that I work with. Because I don't know whether I'm too oblivious or too stupid to be afraid, but I'm just not afraid. And they lock me in a room full of inmates, and or lock me in a room with a serial killer. I don't care. I refuse to be afraid. And anyway, the book says that I can go to the most sordid places in the world, and I can. I went into one of the dingiest bars in Denver and pulled a Hell's Angel out of it. And I walked in there. This was, I don't know whether Gary ever met this guy. Was named Iron Mike, was a Hell's Angel. And he had been on top of a three-story building having his way with some young lady. And they got in the throes of passion, and he rolled off the roof. And when he broke his leg, he really broke his leg. He was having trouble getting it to heal, and anyway, he went into a bar down on 17th Street in Denver and got his nose full of cocaine and got drunk and called me and asked me to come and get him. And I went down there and got him, and by the time I got there, he'd changed his mind. And he said, "I'm not going anywhere." And I said, "Like hell you're not. If I came all the way down here, you by God are going somewhere." And he said, "You can't get me out of here." And I said, "Look, you either start heading for the door in the next 3 seconds, or I'm going to kick you in that leg you broke, and I'm going to break it again. And then I'm going to drag your ass out of this bar. Now you got a choice." So he said, "Okay." And we went over to York Street and had a cup of coffee. And I don't know whatever happened to him, but the point of that whole thing is you don't have to be afraid. Where's our Samoan buddy? I was telling him last Kimo. Night.
Yeah. You can wake him up.
Hey, Kimo, wake up. I was telling him last night. I was telling him last night that in Denver, people say, "You better get your shit together, you're going to wind up with Bob Olson as a sponsor." And you know what? It's because I'm not afraid. And you don't have to be afraid, okay? This stuff either works or doesn't. If you're willing to just drop everything and stop being afraid and stop defending yourself, life works a lot better. One of the biggest challenges in life is not spending all of it in fear. So So is it, at least as it relates to the sixth step, to stay on that, it has to do with, am I willing to drop my defenses? Am I willing to stop defending myself? Am I willing to get rid of all of those things that I have protected myself with for all of these years, and to finally turn to God and say, you're the one that needs to protect me? Okay? So thanks.
I think as often as not, any time I've written some inventory, the time I got to the sixth step and took a good look at it, I'd been dealing with things I was really sick of and ashamed of. And the idea that maybe there's a way that God could take them was really good news. And that's happened most of the time, but there are times when I went ahead and thought I was ready and said the seven-step prayer, and then I went through some periods of behavior that would have said that I probably didn't want those defects to leave and behave that. And I don't know if you remember this, but I'll give you a couple of them, because I had taken the seventh step, we'd gone through the seventh step together, you know, I figure I'm on a spiritual plane at about right here, and no trouble. And two things happened to kind of let me know that maybe I had more to do. And you remember back then, the Denver Broncos had a sorry quarterback named Steve Tensi. And I'm watching the game one day, and he fumbled, and I kicked Julie's antique Fruitwood coffee table, and it broke into several pieces. And I pick them all up before anybody sees me. And I run out behind the house, and I got my tools back in there and all that, and I'm trying to glue this thing back together. And the girls came by and say, how'd the table break, Dad? What happened to the table? And I don't know what I told them. I'm sure it wasn't the truth, but it might have been. But so much of my life had been one of these violent outbursts. Just boom. And just you know, quarterback dropped the ball, and I kick a table and break it to pieces. And it might have been the same week. I'm out in the backyard cutting the grass. And this really dates me, Bob. This is before microwaves. And I remember, I'm hungry, and I remember there was a brand new package of bologna in the refrigerator. And so I go looking for it, and it's frozen in the freezer. And so I threw it, and I threw it hard enough that it buried itself in the sheetrock on the wall. Boop! Stayed right there. There was one other event when things didn't go my way, and it might have been the same week, and I tore the closet door off. If you need that explained to you, we'll do it later. That was my first experience after having done steps 6 and 7. And to this day, I don't know what I'd have done differently. I really did want those defects to be taken away. And maybe that was me being exposed to them to see how inane that is, that I stopped doing them. I don't know that, but surely there's a better way, man. I broke a lot of stuff that needed fixing. That was kind of my experience with it, just a little bit of different thing. I said the prayer, and as far as I know, when I said it, I was as honest as I could be about wanting to be free of all those defenses that I've had. But boy, they sure showed themselves as it was my experience. Those guys in Chicago that I talk about will end each very often, some of them will just have a conversation on the phone. And they'll often end their conversation saying the seven-step prayer together over the phone. And the first few times I did it, I hadn't had it memorized yet. I felt kind of stupid. And that happened again when I swapped fifth steps with Larry. With Larry, the guy in Douglas, Wyoming, we decided we couldn't leave till we said the seventh step prayer again right then and there. And we did it together. And so now maybe I'll ask him if any of them are gone yet. When I had... you got more to say about that?
Only one of the things that that my sponsor used to tell me when I would tell him, I'd say what? I'd say something, and he'd look at me and he would say, "How the hell would you know?" The first time he said it, I was offended because I thought I was smarter than he was. And, you know, if somebody looks at me and says, "How the hell would you know?" it sounds like I'm smart and you're stupid, at least to me. And I would, you know, I'd call him up and tense that something, say my employer is really angry with me, and he'd go, "How the hell would you know?" I go, "Well, that's what it looks like." And he goes, "Well, that may be what it looks like, but things are rarely what they seem to be." And he asked me that question over and over and over again. And it was one of the best things he ever did for me, because it made me question everything I think. And the real truth about this world is that things are rarely what they seem to be. And then my inclination is to take a piece of information, take it to the worst possible conclusion, and then start living there. And I'd go, "Everything's going to hell in a handbasket." And he'd go, "How the hell would you know?" And he was right. You know, most of the time when I thought things were awful, they weren't. So I can walk around making my day miserable, thing and being completely wrong about anything. And one of the things that happens, even after you've been sober for a long time, is that we suffer from faulty perception. And so for most of the time, I don't think that we know what the truth is. So anyway.
After I had... gone up to Chicago and taken fifth steps with those nine guys. I was instructed to go to this restaurant over in LaGrange and had lunch with some of them before I drove back to Indianapolis. And I thought it was all over. And I was tired and I had learned a lot and felt a little beat up on. And we went over there and had lunch, and after lunch, one of them said, "Gary, get your pad and your pencil out. We'll help you with your amends list." And like I said, they had remarkable memories, and so we did. And so I went down, and I listed the amends that we had talked about in the inventory, and then Paul asked, "How about those amends you owe that you didn't have any resentments at?" And so we listed more out on inventory, because I owed a lot of money. I'd been lying about money and everything else all along with that. And we come up with the amends list, and the guys that are 3 and 4 years sober, and one of them that was at that time in his 30s, I guess, said, "How the hell have you stayed sober this long doing it?" And they really believed. They were asking a very serious question, because that was their experience, and they didn't believe you could stay sober doing it the way I did. And they're right. I don't know why I did, but we went through that list, and it became real clear to me, just sitting right there with that this is probably my only shot at making this deal. And I don't know why it was so different at that time, other than I didn't want to hurt anybody else. And so took that list, and most of the amends on that list at that point in time were financial. I had lied and cheated my way through life about finances up until that point, just completely. I had borrowed money. Well, that's what I said. It was, "I'm borrowing the money to pay you back." And then, of course, I never paid you back. And it was huge. It was just an amount of money I couldn't conceive me ever being incapable of making enough money to pay him back. I couldn't do it. But I knew the time was we had to sit down and try it. And one of the guys gave me some coaching on how to set that up with that. But I was still making, I'd still do anything they told me. Being willing is one thing. And I don't remember how, I was listening to Mike Bessinius one time at this point. And he says, you know that willingness has a sound? Mm-hmm. You know it? Yeah. And that's the sound. Or it can be a doorbell ringing. It's not an email. And it may not be a letter, probably, but you need to be talking to us. Anyway, I went together and I went home and I put together a list on an 18-column columnar pad where I listed everybody I could think of that I owed the money to. And then you went down the pad and then you get a payday and you went out as far as you could make that payday stretch. And then you get another payday and you'd stretch that one out till it stretched. And then before the end of the day on payday, you were broke again and you had enough money for gas and groceries to get you through to the next payday. And that went on for a long time. But that was probably the only physical evidence I'd ever had about my amends was that I was willing to do anything. Because I hadn't been willing to do any of that stuff. I had made all the amends I could that didn't involve money. Up until that point. There's one out there that's still out there and don't know where, tried, quit to find her. But I can't do it, I guess. So I'm just down to the financial amends, and I literally got a list of them going across. Now, many of them were family. Well, not many, I don't have a big family, but my parents and Julie's parents and Julie's brother, and we were talking about Dick last night, old Dick money. And all these businesses that were out there. And these debts went back before sobriety and after sobriety. Just because I quit drinking didn't seem to be necessary to stop lying and cheating and stealing. That's what I had done. And that was my first real physical vision of the harm I'd caused when I could list them right there in front of me. Many of them were people that needed the money that went through that. And so I went through that for years. And that was a big part of my amends list because most of them were financial. And I was held accountable by Paul. It seemed like it was about every Friday. And he'd ask me, who did you pay this time? I don't know how he remembered them all. To this day, brightest guy I ever saw. Somebody said to me one time, I hope I'm as sharp as Paul is when I get that old. And I said, shit, I wish I was that sharp right now. From that point on, and the day finally came, when it was clear to me, I didn't see an answer other than continually going through that process for the rest of our life. And I guess I should have thrown into a lottery for a boat, but I found a different one. I found a better one. I went downstairs one night after trying to do that and discouraged, broke again. I'd had a paycheck 3 hours before that. Here we are, we're back in the same boat again. And really feeling sorry for myself, and I told Julie, I said, you know, I don't think I can live long enough or ever make enough money to pay all these bills. I just don't see it happen. I don't have any idea how to do it. And And I sat down in the chair and tried to pout, and she ignored me. The next morning, she said she had an idea. Now, if you got one of those wives, and they say, have an idea, watch yourself. Because you don't know what's going to happen. But her idea was that we had been living in that house for longer than we'd lived anywhere, and we had equity in the home. I'd had the same job for longer than I'd ever worked anywhere. I wonder if that's still true. You nodded. You think it is. Okay. And I had 401k in the retirement and all of that. And she said, you know, Gary, we have all that, and you have that. It appears that we could maybe sell a house, cash in the 401k and all the retirement, and pay off all the amends and the little bit of current debt we have, and buy a used trailer house. That sounds more dramatic than mobile home, than trailer house. And I thought, oh, she can't be serious. She can't be serious. And I knew she was. And so I ran out to go to work, is what I did, to get away from it. So when I got back that night, I told her, I said, let's call Paul and tell him about your idea and see what he says. And I'm sure he's got a way out of that. So I call him, and I said, now, you've listened to some of my stuff for a long time. I said, we have an idea here that maybe we could cash in all the retirement and sell the house and take the proceeds and pay off all the amends and some current debt, and there'd be enough left to buy a used trailer house to live in. Said, how crazy does that sound? And his answer was, he said, that was the sanest thing he'd heard me say in 20 years. And he said, was it your idea? And I said, no, it was Julie's, and he said he thought so. Often said that he was Julie's biggest fan, I think. And so to go on, the day came where we did sell a house, and all those amends did get paid, and we did. We found a trailer to move into, and the truth of that was that's pretty nice living. It's pretty easy. And out in our part of the country, they call it winterizing your house. That's when you're caulking windows and putting plastic over them or whatever it is to keep it out and keep your pipes from freezing and all of that. Those trailers, you crawl under it maybe that far, and you take this big long extension cord that they call heat tape, and you plug it in. It's winterized. You're done. It's on. And what came from that is trying not to go into all of that. There were people that I'd harmed greatly. Julie's folks, I had even signed notes that I'd pay them back, and they were really proud of those promissory notes, but they hadn't meant a damn thing to me. I hadn't paid them a dime with that. And when we got them paid, but that was only part of the amend. And so I had to tell Julie's dad that the biggest part of mine was my amend. He may have thought the finances, but for me, it was for me to be grateful for the kindness he had always shown me. Because of the way I had treated his daughter and his granddaughters, and that sort of had to worry him no end. It had to drive him nuts with that. And so when I called him on that, I told him that. And before I got around to the money. And I made the mistake of telling him that I loved him. And he said, oh, shit, and he gave the phone to Grandma. And so I went through the whole thing with Julie's mother. And we get to this point, and I ask her, have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she said, right down to the last penny. And so we made arrangements to pay that back. Then later we sold the house, and she got the money for that. A few years later, quite a few years later, Well, first, the day I called and Julie's dad answered the phone was a Tuesday. The next Thursday, he was out using his snowblower and had a stroke and died. Close, huh? Stupid, huh? That should have been done a long time ago. Give him some peace. Then a few years later, she died. And for some reason, her mother died. And for some reason, Julie's brother wanted me to do the, what do you call it when you say nice?
Eulogy.
The eulogy, yeah. And so I told the story about effectively what I just told you and about Julie's mom saying right down to the last penny. And that, because I thought it was indicative of hers and all that. This is the same grandma that always had candy hidden in the kitchen cabinets and all of that stuff. And just as sweet a woman as you'd ever want to know with that. And so I shared that at the funeral. And out there, I don't know what they do here, but the funeral in Wyoming and that sort of thing, you don't have a wake at the funeral home. But after the funeral, everybody goes to the home of the survivors and brings food, and you have a nice time in there. And Julie's brother disappeared. And he walked up and he gave me the promissory note that said, paid in full. And stamped on it, he says, I didn't know what this was about. He said, but I sure don't need it. And he gave it to me. That's just one of many with that. And I can hardly tell the story just about the amends without going on through that. But what do we want to do about time now? I hate to do that to you. Do you need a break? Go ahead. They send me?
I sat down. I went through my inventory. The book says it made a list of all persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. And the next line in the book is, we did it when we took inventory. So most of my amends is on my inventory. And I sat down with Don and started going through this. And he had asked me to take each one of those people on the inventory and write down what the harm was. And I asked him why I was doing that. And he said, because I don't want you wasting people's time without knowing why you're there. And just walking in there and saying, I'm sure I harmed you because I am who I am, is not going to fill the bill, and some mumbling apology isn't going to do it either. So we went down through the list. I told you I was a bill collector in Chicago, and back then those things got physical periodically. And he said, "What are you going to do about those guys?" And I said, "Some of those people threatened to kill me." And things got pretty contentious. And if I have to go back and make amends to those people that I had harmed when I was out collecting money, I'm liable to really get hurt. And he looked me right straight in the eye and said, God either is or he isn't. I don't like the answer. And then he said, what are you going to do about your dad? And I said, nothing. And he said, why not? And I said, well, he was the one that caused all the harm. I mean, he was the bad drunk that was beating me up when I was a kid and doing all that stuff. And why the hell should I go make amends to him? And he said, didn't you tell me that he called you every year on your birthday? And I said, yeah. And he said, what'd you do? And I said, well, when he called, he was so drunk I couldn't understand what he was saying, so I had to hang up on him. And he said, why would you do that? And I said, because he was a drunk. And he looked at me and he said, you're a drunk. Compelling argument. And he said, are you willing to see that you've held your dad at arm's length your whole life because he was an alcoholic, and you didn't know what that looked like till you were an alcoholic? And he said, do you have any idea how difficult it is for a chronic, everyday, skid row drunk to remember one day a year to call you and to try and touch you? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And he said, well, that's what you're making amends for. And I said, well, let me tell you the rest of the story. My dad lives in an old army home in Wisconsin, state home. And he had a stroke, and he's not supposed to be capable of any kind of continuous thought, and he's living in a wheelchair, and he's not his mind is supposed to be gone. So why should I go all the way to Wisconsin to make amends to somebody that isn't going to understand anyway? And he said this because this is about cleaning off your side of the street. And it doesn't make any difference whether he understands or not. You get in your car and drive to Wisconsin and make amends to him. When I mentioned to you before that we weren't given choices about doing this, that's the way it was. It was just like, either do what it says or get the hell out. Right? That seems like kind of a pretty strict position to take. But we're not dealing with the common cold here. So I went back to Chicago and made some amends there of the people that I could find anyway. And some of them, I said, what can I do to make that right? Because the making amends is really about balancing the books. And those people that I did get to see, I would say, what can I do to make that right? And I got a variety of answers. Some of them were, you can't. Some of them were, stay the hell away from me. And some of them were, we're glad that you found a solution. You know, I went into that thinking I was done. I mean, I thought I'd walk into somebody's house in Chicago and they'd go, hey, you remember me? And I'd take a bullet for it. And then I went to make amends to my dad. I drove up to the Grand Army home and went inside and I said, my name is Bob Olson. I'm looking for my dad. His name is Bob Olson too. And they said, that's him sitting over there in a wheelchair. So I walked up to him and I stood in front of him and I said, hi, I'm your son Bob. I hadn't seen him in probably a decade. And he looked at me and I think he got it. He looked like he got it anyway. He couldn't say anything. And I said, I need to talk with you. And I took his wheelchair and I wheeled him off into this empty room and sat down in front of him. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And when I said that, he got really sad. And I said, but I don't drink anymore, and I'm part of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason why I'm here is because I've harmed you, and I want to try and do the right thing. I want to try and make that right with you. And when I told him that I didn't drink anymore, he looked elated. And I knew something, that there was some measure of understanding in what he was hearing. And I said, I've harmed you, and I don't know what to do to make that right. But I want you to know that I'm all right now. And that I understand that you were making an attempt to touch me every year on my birthday, and I regret having hung up on you. And I just didn't know what was going on. And then I left, went back to Colorado, and he died. He died, he had adult onset diabetes. And they his only other living relative besides my sister was his brother, my uncle. And they called my uncle from the hospital and they said, he's losing all the circulation in his extremities. And they said, we're going to have to amputate his foot. And so, well, they said, we need your permission to do that. So that my uncle Leif gave him permission to amputate my dad's foot. And so they did. And it wasn't too much after that that they called my uncle Leif and told him they were going to have to amputate his other foot. And then they were going to have to amputate one of his hands or his fingers, and then another piece of his leg. And back then they couldn't manage adult onset diabetes, so you just would eventually lose circulation in your extremities, and if they didn't amputate it, you'd get gangrene and die. And after about the fourth call, the doctor said, you know, we're going to run out of pieces to cut off here. And, you know, we need to ask you a very difficult question, and that is, should we just let him die? Or should we keep taking pieces off him? And it was my uncle's opinion that they ought to let him die. And I don't question that. I mean, it was his decision. I don't know one way or the other. And so they made the decision to not do any more surgery. And at some level, my dad knew that they were going to let him die, and he had nothing to say about it. And so when anyone would come anywhere close to him, he'd scream. He had no other way to communicate. He'd just scream. And he'd do that out of despair, which is one of the four horsemen of alcoholism. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. So he would scream. And that's the way he died. My dad was married 9 times. And the only one that showed up at his funeral was his brother. I was told, my uncle said, look, Bob, I know how you felt about your dad. And we're just going to have a simple ceremony out behind the hospital in the cemetery there, and we're going to bury him. And you don't need to send any flowers, and you certainly don't have to travel halfway across the country to be here to see us put a dead body in a hole. So, you know, I just wanted you to know. Now, I'll tell you something about all that. When my uncle called me and said, your dad died, I said, really? And he said, yeah, and we're going to have this funeral and da-da-da-da. And I said, okay. And after I had that phone conversation, my wife was watching at the time, was watching me. And she said, who is that? And I said, Leif. And she said, what'd he have to say? And I said, he told me that my dad died. And she went, oh my God, I am so sorry. And I said, don't be. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, you grew up in a family where everybody loved each other and you all got to spend a lot of time together and do all the rest of that. When I grew up, I got beaten up by my dad and I was glad he was the hell out of my life. And then later in life, I learned a lot of other stuff about it. But see, my relationship with my dad was one where I didn't want to be anywhere near him. And so when he died, it was like somebody down the block died. Didn't have anything to do with me. And I went around wondering what the hell was the matter with me. I mean, aren't you supposed to feel something? I never shed a tear when my dad died. And after that, and the only reason why I'm telling you this is because I'm sure that some of you that are here today have had this same experience. So I think I'm wired badly, okay? And I was saying to my wife, I said, I don't feel anything. I don't feel remorse. I don't feel regret. I don't feel anything. I made amends. I did what I was supposed to do. He died, and that's the end of it. No tears, no nothing. And I said, but you know what? When my mother dies, there's going to be tears. And then my mother died. And nothing happened. Didn't shed a tear. I lived in foster homes when I grew up. And I got to know my mother better later in life. But when she died, same thing happened. And I'm thinking, how come I can't shed a tear when my mother dies? And it's because I just didn't grow up like a lot of people. I didn't grow up with any sense of family. I didn't think I was part of anything. And one of the reasons why I always felt like I was damaged goods was because I had no sense of that. And people would sit there and compare me to those, to both my mother and my father. And I had this bad opinion of myself, see. And I found out, because I chased it, that if you don't grow up in sort of a normal family situation, you don't have it. Now, I'll tell you what, I got 5 sons and 2 grandsons. And I would jump in front of a bullet for any one of them. And heaven forbid any one of those guys goes away. But, you know, sometimes we grow up in situations that don't provide us with some of the emotional things that other people have. And that's just what happened. And people go, well, you really had an abnormal childhood. But you want to know the truth? If it's the only one you have, you think it's normal. Okay? So if you can't dredge up tears, or if you can't become emotional, or if you can't feel an overwhelming sense of sadness because someone dies in your life that you weren't close to, don't feel bad about it. You aren't prepared to do that. And, you know, we can either spend the rest of our lives bemoaning our circumstances, or we can get on about it. Now, close to 3.5 years, I think, for me to pay financial amends. I went to my uncle, and I said, my uncle was a banker. And I went to him, Leif, and I said, I owe all this money. I don't know what to do. And he said, how did you get into that deep of trouble? And I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and I needed a drink, and I ran a loan company, and I know how to manipulate money. And he said, well, all right. And I said, my concern isn't about how I got into it. My concern is, how do I get out of it? And he said, well, it's fairly simple. And I said, good. And he said, here's how you do it. And I said, I'm listening. And he said, you start paying now and you pay till it's paid. Could you give me another solution?
Yeah, anything.
So what I did was I took 30% of my net income and I paid amends with it every month for 3 years. And all of a sudden I owed, out of all that money that I owed, I only had owed $2,500 after that. And Gary was making a joke about it before. I grew up in Wisconsin and there's a lot of lakes in Wisconsin. You know, the Minnesota license plate says 10,000 lakes, but they really got closer to 20,000 up there, and Wisconsin has 10,000 lakes. And so when I was a kid, because we didn't have any money, I lived in a little house that was up on cement blocks that had 3 rooms in it, and it's a bad neighborhood and people would throw a dead dog or something under your house and you didn't even know it was there until it smelled so bad you couldn't go in to get it. Anyway, it was not a great place to live. And I used to go down by this river in Madison and watch guys come by in boats. And there was a lot of lakes right there. And these guys would look like they were having a great deal of fun, and I'd sit on the riverbank and watch all these boats go by. And they'd have families in them and all this stuff, and I would sit there and say, when I grow up, I'm going to have a boat, and I'm going to have a family, and I'm going to do all this stuff. And all my life, I wanted a boat, and I never had enough money to get it. And when I was almost done paying my mends, I paid so much of my income that for 3 years, we really didn't go out much. Rarely went to restaurants. I had two sons and a wife, and we almost never went to restaurants and almost never did, you know, anything beyond the most meager kinds of things you had to do for your life. And they had a boat show in Denver, and I went over there, took the kids there. I said, we need to at least go out and do something. So I said, would you like to go to this boat show? Boat travel and whatever the hell it was.
Okay. 2 minutes.
And the Bassmasters were in there with a raffle. And they had $10 of my money before I knew I had it out of my pocket. I felt like Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, when he gave the cow away for a handful of beans. And I had 3 lottery tickets. And they called me the next day and told me I won the boat. It was a brand new Rebel bass boat. And I went down there to look at it and made the mistake of taking my 2 kids with me. And they're climbing around in the boat going, oh, is this going to be fun? We're going to go fishing, and are we going to go water skiing and do all that stuff? And I went and asked the Rebel bass boat dealer, this is in 1973, or it's 1975, and I said, how much is that boat worth? And he said, $2,500 wholesale. Oh. So what do? Keep the boat? Keep paying off your men? Sell the boat? What is it? So spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. I had to tell my kids they couldn't have the boat. And I sold the boat to some guy from Texas for $2,500 and paid off the rest of my amends. I promised my kids they'd have a boat. And 3 years later, I bought a 17.5-foot Cobalt with a Boss 302 Ford V8 in it. That you could troll at 60 miles an hour. Thanks. There's a break.